It was an absolute pleasure to catch up at his home in London with Chris Hamilton. Now, Chris and I went to school together. This is over 30 years ago. And Chris is, and in so many ways, he just hasn't changed at all. He's a full-time professional and award-winning musician and composer. Now, he started his career as a lawyer. He went to Oxford to study law. He worked in the city for a big corporate firm in both London and New York. And we talk about having gone full circle. Chris learned the piano when he was very young. And I remember him playing in school assemblies. He was very, very talented as a musician from a very young age. Now, we talk about our school days, the importance of learning, how Chris loved standing up and performing from a young age. We talk about how school can be a traumatic experience, whether, and this is a reference to a film that we discovered in the course of our conversation that we both love, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion, whether you are on the A list or the Z list. We talk about how we are here because of the past, and Chris says he wouldn't change any of it. Chris explains why we are the lucky generation in that we have memories of life pre-social media. We talk about social media posts and mental health, the implications of what we post, how we are celebrities in our own little bubbles. We talk about Chris's love of music. He performs often these days as the headliner on cruise ships. And we discuss how we both enjoy hearing the sound of our own voices. We find out about Chris's lockdown cabarets. We discover that as part of his stage shows, he has memorized every Oscar-winning song since 1934. Chris asks me about my diaries. I ask Chris about his favorite songs. We learn that he has composed songs since he was a child, has written a musical, and we discover why he is his own worst critic. An absolute joy for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to meet Chris Hamilton. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a huge pleasure today in London to catch up with Chris Hamilton. Now, Chris, we went to school together. We were just chatting beforehand.
We did.
31 years ago since we left school.
Astonishing. Yeah.
And whether we remember it very well or choose to remember it is another matter. Maybe we'll come back to this. But do you want to say a little bit about what you're doing now?
What am I doing now? Well, I'm a full-time musician and composer, having had quite a few varied careers, really. I went to Oxford University to do law, and I worked in the city for a very big corporate firm, Simmons & Simmons. I worked in New York with the same firm. Then I gave that up to go to acting school in Guildford, Guildford School of Acting. And now I've gone full circle because I started piano very, very young. And I'm back to my main love, basically, the piano.
And it's so interesting because a few years ago, I was always thinking, what is everybody up to these days? Now, with you, and I think I said this to you over Twitter, I've got this recollection of, I think it was our last school assembly, sixth form assembly. And for me, A-levels were probably the most traumatic experience of, of my life, certainly up to that point. And I remember you, I think maybe we had a few minutes to spare, or the teacher sort of last minute said, you know, can somebody play the piano? And of course, Chris to the rescue. And I remember it was Beverly Craven's Promise Me, which was in the charts that week. And you didn't just play it, you did it sort of like 10 times. You completely ramped it up, camped it up. And it was just one of those moments, I look back and I thought, whatever happens, I've got these A-levels coming up, I may or may not, I did in the end, go to university. And I just thought, there was a sparkle, there was just a sense from what you did there that made me think, you know, there's, if you want it, the world has colour, it has vibrancy, it has cabaret. And,
yes,
and of course, and so to learn that that's what you're doing these days is just phenomenal.
It is amazing to think of those moments, seminal moments you do remember. And actually, Janine Sully, she, I remember doing GCSE music with her at A-level, then she went on to teach music in the Cayman Islands. And she remembers vividly as well, because she wanted to sing that song, I think, in her A-level music. She played violin beautifully and piano, but she did voice as well. And so she sang that song, Promise Me. And then there was Lucy Case, remember her? She sang backup vocals. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I mean, that we were saying before, those school memories are a little bit vague for me. But certain things stand out for sure.
Because I think I was probably more of a background person in some ways. Do you remember the days, maybe it was just before you went to the schools, I know you were 14 when you went, when the Top 40 would come out on a Tuesday lunchtime. And in those days, people would bring their transistor radios, their huge getterbusters into school.
That old.
Yeah, and we really are. And people would bring them into school, and at lunchtime, quarter to one, you'd have the countdown. And what was funny is that in those days, I really wanted to hear, but I didn't necessarily want people to know that that was my thing. It was more like, well, that's what I'm interested in, but I don't really know these people who bring their radios right. in. So I would like pretend just to be standing around in the corner listening. And of course, I was completely taking it all in. These days, of course, that's my thing all over.
Yeah.
But isn't it interesting that sometimes the things that we remember are the things that may really come as a huge surprise to someone else. They're like, I didn't even know that you were paying attention.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I can definitely relate to that because, yes, as you mentioned, I joined your school at 14. My original school had shut down. So that was quite a traumatic experience. Most of the people from my school went to the other Catholic school. But my parents decided, oh, Bishop of Llandaff was a really good one. And so they moved heaven and earth to get me in there, even though I was a Catholic, but it worked. And that definitely, for me, was the sort of blossoming stage. I mean, in the beginning, I was still very, people don't believe it now when I tell them, but very, very self-conscious, very quiet, a loner. I mean, in the previous schools, I didn't really have friends. I would just, whereas most people would sort of live for the breaks, the lunch breaks, the afternoon breaks, I hated them. It was quite anathema. I would prefer to be actually in class, learning. Sounds so sad looking back now. But it wasn't the cool thing. And I don't suppose that things have changed that much even now in schools. You know, people live for the football and the sports and the socialising. But yes, I remember being painfully shy. But then it changed because of the music. Because then I think there was a band that people were in school and they asked me to play keyboard or piano in it. And that sort of changed things in the sixth form for sure, for me. I was more popular then and I sort of... takes people longer to grow into their personalities than others, I think.
Yeah, and you're right, because I'm in touch with some of those people now. And actually, there's a level of acceptance. And maybe there was even then, but maybe it was just a perception when you were of a certain age. And this notion of difference, of conformity, like you.
Yeah.
I loved learning. For me, that was what education was about. And I was never a sport person, but it was always, you know, the people who went on to be the head boy or whatever, they were very sort of sport conscious. Mm. And because that wasn't my thing, I was always we were talking about Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. Mine too, the A list and the Z list. And I was certainly, I was more Z than A, I think it's fair to say. But that was a long time ago. And I also think that, and you probably found it as well, because you said you were painfully shy, but obviously you're now very accustomed to sitting and performing in front of a large audience.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that you completely come alive in that context.
Well, I think even back then in school, I mean, shy in the sense of not being particularly social, but I remember, it's flooding back to me now actually, remember a guy called Lewis Pugsley?
Yes.
I remember sort of joining up with him for the debating society and then competing in these things. So from a young age, I sort of loved standing up and, you know, talking and orating. But I think we were similar from that point of view because you had all this inside you. But we weren't, certainly when I first joined the school, out there being social animals. And I think, as you say, the fact that we were eager to learn, we weren't sportsmen, that counted against you. What was the word? Spod. I wonder if people still use that word now, spod. If you were a spod, you were a teacher's pet, you sort of, you know, wanted to work hard.
And it's so funny, isn't it? Because it's almost as though, because we went to a good school, I say, and I knew it was a good school.
Yes.
When I went to university and was with people, I mean, I know you went to Oxford and I went to Lampeter, but there were people who were saying to me that in their school, they were one of only literally maybe half a dozen who went on to university. Whereas at our school,
really?
It was the other way around.
Yeah.
There may be half a dozen who didn't. And they were like, oh gosh, you know, they're not following the same path. So it was a strange thing of being a school where it wasn't cool to be teacher's pet, but there was a level of aptitude which people also saw through. So maybe when they were with their parents, they were like, you know, completely with it and they were doing all the right things. But at school, they didn't want to betray that side of them. But it was a hugely competitive environment from my recollection.
It was. There were a lot of bright people there. The teachers were so supportive. I can remember that. They always went the extra mile. No, I don't know, the house thing, wasn't it? Yeah. David, John, and I remember, I spoke to Marianne Sharp the other night. She came to a show I did in London, and we were reminiscing wildly. And I think she said, yes, you can remember me conducting my house's choir, and I was so competitive in ambitious, and we had to win those blue ribbons or whatever they were. I mean, it does seem like we're talking about a lifetime ago, but it's amazing how things do come back, just chatting about them.
Yeah, and also I think we probably should talk about that film, because when it came out in 97, Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, I thought, that's exactly why I could never have anything to do with people I went to school with. Because at that point, I was like Romeo and Michelle, in the sense of feeling maybe a bit inadequate, maybe a bit awkward. And maybe I felt that I would be asked by people who, in my mind at least, were going to be far more successful than me. You know, because I did an arts frame, I did religious studies, I was one of literally half a dozen, fewer even, who did that at A-level. A lot of people were doing sciences, lots of practical subjects. They were very clever people. And I suppose I always felt in their shadow. So when I saw that film, it sort of reinforced what it's like to, you know, to go to school and perhaps not be the most popular person. But then, when the many decades pass and you've got children of your own, and you start to sort of step back and think, well, hang on a minute, why am I still judging myself by the standards of people who were 16, as I was, all those decades ago? And then something shifts.
I think that's true. I mean, I don't know why I suddenly thought of an analogy. It's almost like somebody who has been overweight their entire life, and then through, I don't know, change of lifestyle, eating, exercise, loses all that weight, but deep down, they still see themselves and consider themselves a fat person. And all those taunts they were subjected to as a fat person don't really go away. Mm. But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think school, people can be quite a traumatic experience for everyone. And even if you were in the Z list looking up at people, say, at the A list, they had a whole other host of issues going on, problems. You don't know what people were experiencing at home. I think in Bishop, the majority of people came from very nurturing families, very supportive families. But, you know, we were lucky in that respect. But it's amazing what you carry with you. And I'm sure if you met people now in a school reunion type situation, you'd be so surprised. And maybe the power balance shifts as well. It's, I mean, going back to that film, what's her name? Kirsty Masters, who basically, her husband's cheating on her, she's pregnant again, and she was always a pretty, flighty young one, and, you know, and then, I'm actually in shock that you know that film and love that film, because many people haven't even seen it. Lisa Kudrow from Friends, and
Jennifer, and Mira Sorvino.
Yes.
Now, no, and I'll tell you the story, because I saw it with my sister and her then husband, and it would have been August 1997, and this is, it's very interesting, because obviously, reunions and nostalgia are completely my thing, hence this podcast. Back then, it was more that I was fascinated by the journeys that people had taken, but I was too closely linked to that era. It was only, 6 years after we left school. So that's the sort of film. I think we all have those sort of go-to movies that sometimes, it's not because they're great films, it's not because the critics are raving about them, but it touches a spot, and you know, there's always a point, often after midnight, you know, when you know you're a bit tired, but you know that this is the right thing to write at the right moment, and it connects. And everything about it, that sort of notion of being awkward. But the perception at the age of 16, 17, compared to what happened, I know that film's 10 years on, but in our case now we're talking 3 decades on. And something shifts, because when you're at school, I think there was that need to conform, or a perception that, you know, if you're in the in crowd, you sort of behave in a certain way. It's the fear of being laughed at, of being bullied. But what's really interesting is that the older I get, the more I think, well, actually, the thing that makes me stand out the most probably are those idiosyncrasies.
Yeah.
Maybe I was an extrovert without realising it, but I was just a very awkward one. So suddenly I think that maybe my greatest strength is the very thing that at school was the weakness. And if I see it in those terms, I know I could face those people again and actually really enjoy their company.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't regret any of it, because from my point of view, not so much Bishop, but the preceding school, as I mentioned, all my focus as a student was on the work, doing well. I was always very competitive and ambitious, but on the music. So people would ask me today, oh, do you practice the piano every day? And I'll say, no, because I actually put in all the work when I was young. So if I had got in with the cool ground, in inverted commas, sooner, then something would have given, would have to give, the piano or the scholastic side of life. So we are exactly here now because of the past, and I think that I wouldn't change any of it.
Yeah, and I think that's right, because one of the things that I found, and I suppose in this podcast, it would be very hard for somebody to construct a past, in the sense that I am the person I am because of the things, and often it was the music or maybe the films, as well as the people of a particular generation. It was the elections that took place while we were at school or at university. Yeah. It was the particular the time and the place. And you can't change that. You can't invent that.
No.
Or you'd be found out very quickly. And so I think it's a case of owning that. And, you know, even things like, you know, one of the things that I remember most from university is that if we wanted to speak to our family, we didn't have mobile phones in those days, so we'd have to use a phone box.
Queuing
and it was always cheaper at 6 o'clock in the evening.
Yes.
So at 6 o'clock, everybody would be queuing up to speak to their parents. So, of course, when I explain that to my children now, who also find the world of CDs, let alone vinyl, to be incomprehensible, you look back and you just think, that's so weird, because these days, of course, you have a phone and you message people and you text people, and it's very easy. If you've got an appointment and you're late, you just text them and they say,
exactly.
Yeah, sure, I'll see you in 10 minutes. In those days, there was no way of getting hold of someone.
It is hard, I think, for people who didn't live through it to even understand. I think we're the lucky generation because we know what it was like pre-social media. We know how actually liberating that was. I mean, I cannot even imagine, but I can because I speak to friends with teenage children, what it is like now. I mean, if you're somebody who's being bullied in school, that can carry on over into after school. You know, with the internet, with the groups not being invited to the cool party. And in the past, you wouldn't necessarily have known unless people talk about it. Now you could see it plastered all over social media. So I think parents now have an even more difficult job to navigate those waters, to speak to their children, you know, but not necessarily just daughters, but sons as well. Careful what you put online.
Yeah.
Because it will be there. Even Snapchat, which is something I refuse to go on, that really is for you. You know, people think, oh, it's just gone in a second. Well, it's not. People can take screenshots, and now we know things can come back to haunt you decades later.
Yeah. And I was just thinking what you were saying about what is going on in their home life. In a way that perhaps it's easier now, there are more opportunities, or so it feels, certainly in terms of like senior tutor work I used to do at my workplace, you know, getting people to open up about things that in our day we didn't have counsellors, we didn't have senior tutors or therapists who were there at hand. But I think it was about a year ago, because Facebook tells me so, was it Everyone's Talking About Jamie, about the boy?
Yes.
When the film version of that. And so he's bullied. But then you see the home life. There's one scene towards the end where you see the home life of his big tormentor, and it's a very sad life. And suddenly you think, hang on a minute, you know, bullies are terrible. But then you see that the bully himself is being bullied in the home environment.
The bullies become... Yeah. The people who are bullied become the bully. Yeah, the cycle of abuse.
Yeah.
But you know, even going back to that, I mean, it's interesting you say queuing up for the phone box. It was exactly the same for me, obviously. But I used to love, I'd still do, obviously, that's combining my job now, but travelling. So at university, each summer vacation, they were quite long, 3.5 months of Oxford, I would go away by myself to India. And then one year, I had a one-way ticket to Cairo, arriving there at midnight. Now, looking back, it's astonishing because I was the youngest of two children. I was always quite a mummy's boy. We discussed school, being quite shy initially. So the thought of me, aged 19, buying a one-way ticket to Egypt and then travelling around having no clue, this is before the internet, there was no map, you would buy a Lonely Planet guide perhaps, travel through Egypt, Jordan, Syria, which obviously nobody can do now, Turkey, Israel, and my parents would be lucky if they get a cursory postcard once a month. Now, I was talking about this the other day and people were absolutely fascinated with it by saying, well, how did that work? Because now, if you're... I mean, how old are your children?
So my eldest is 10 and my youngest are 7. I say are because they're twins.
Okay. So you've got all this to come, but when they go on their first trip, I think usually people go with friends, but I was always a bit of a loner, as we said. But now, at least you have things like WhatsApp. I mean, remember when you travelled abroad when we were younger, the thought of phoning home, well, I mean, you wouldn't do it. It was extortionate. It's something you wouldn't even get your head around. Now, WhatsApp, you can constantly be in touch. But the thing is, when I look back on those periods of me which made me the person I am, all that solo travelling and negotiating, backpacking all around the world, I'm glad there wasn't all of that and Instagram where I wouldn't be enjoying it without having feeling the need to take pictures and stories and reporting on it. So it was liberating in a way. I think people feel now that, you know, access to everything is liberating. I'm not so sure it can actually be quite straitjacket, pulling on it, if you like. That's not even a phrase, it's not. Because you feel you have to let people know what you're doing. Family, loved ones, but then the wider world. I mean, you know, I'm a big family. People listening to this point might think he obviously hates the internet. Not at all. I mean, I'm constantly on Instagram. I love doing stories. It's like being a mini reporter wherever you are. So that's what I'm saying. I'm glad that we've traversed those two worlds, because I can see the pitfalls. I can see, not to take it so seriously, that if you were prone to depression or anxiety, watching people's carefully curated life on there, which it is, you rarely see somebody doing a story of them sitting on the sofa feeling miserable or hard done by. It's always the positive bits.
And I think you're right. And I think sometimes you see somebody's posts, and I think in mine, what I enjoy doing is putting clearly very positive. I'm aware that sometimes it almost looks like I'm showing off. Like, look how I'm interviewing today. I'm with Chris. or, look, I'm at the cinema once again. But I think people who know me also know that there's a lot more going on. And also, it's my way of saying to people, I'm okay. Because if somebody's putting very happy posts, I suppose some people might think, God, here he goes again. But you also think, that person seems happy, he's okay, and he's enjoying what he's doing.
Yes.
And you think, good for him. And you can either read the post or move on to the next. But if somebody was putting out stuff that really said, I'm in a really bad way, then you're like, oh God, you're doing this in a public forum. That's not really the right place to do it. And you'd worry for them. But also, I think that Facebook is very good sometimes at allowing your personality to come out. It's like the way, you know, I always think, if you were doing a radio show or a TV show, what form, what genre would it take? And until you actually do it, you don't know, because I'm very good at talking about my relationship history and so on, but I'm also not stupid enough to do that on social media. So there's something very positive there, which perhaps compensates for the fact that in other facets of my life, things are not so great. But you're carving that niche yourself, and there's something very autonomous about that.
Exactly. I agree with everything you just said. I think that I've analysed this a lot, believe it or not. Like, there's different people on social media. There's the people who, as I say, they will curate the best. They will filter themselves into obscurity so that you wouldn't actually recognise them in real life. Then you have people, so they're sort of people who, they're showing off without necessarily knowing they are. Then you have people, I think this is the dangerous category, who genuinely suffer with mental health issues, but realise that if you put a post online saying, you know who your friends are, or this very sort of cryptic message, that will elicit many, are you okay, hun, what's going on? And then that will elicit a lot more attention. So I remember once, because like I think the majority of people, I don't suffer from clinical depression, but I certainly have ups and downs. And people would generally think of me from looking at Facebook and Twitter and Instagram that I'm a upbeat, positive, happy person. Yes, I am to a degree, but there's also another side. And once this happened where, I can't even remember what caused it, but I was in a bit of a mood. And I went on Instagram and just said, it's almost embarrassing actually thinking about it, but I sort of said, you know, look, just so everybody doesn't think everything's good all the time, perfect relationship, perfect life, perfect job. You know, I'm feeling like this today, and it's a terrible way to feel. So I send love to anybody who struggles with this daily or even occasionally. And then the next morning I woke up and thought, oh, that was a bit cringe for me, I should take it down. But the number of people who wrote privately and said, oh, thank you so much for writing that, because exactly as I thought, people would look at what we choose to put on there and think, and feel envious, or feel, why aren't I doing that, or why aren't I happy all the time and beaming and positive. And so that, for me, I didn't do it again, because I thought I'd made the point. But I can see how some people, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but I think some people might do it for attention. And there's somebody on Facebook, I won't mention the name, obviously, who he suffers from conditions, autism, ADHD, and he's very vocal on there. And what a surprise, I don't even know him in real life, but we're sort of Facebook friends. What surprises me is that a lot of his Facebook friends can be really negative towards him and say, oh, sort yourself out or snap out of it. And then the other day he sort of said that, you know, he'd attempted suicide. And I think it's horrifying seeing, well, I've got a fair few numbers and followers, people I don't even know who feel they can't reach out to sort of a really good friend. They have to publicise this to the world. But I think the younger generation, they will really say what's going on, what they're thinking. I mean, it's almost like people want to shock these days. It's not like projecting the Stepford Wife, beautiful 1950s life. People will go the other island and say graphic things on Twitter, which I think, gosh, did you honestly need to share that?
There's an irony there as well, because these days we have to be careful at work that we don't publish confidential information, even the names of students. So, you know, when I got my degree, it was all plastered on the wall of our building. Everyone could see who got first, 2-1, 2-2, and all the rest of it. These days, you don't know what anybody else got.
Oh,
the
really?
Students will, yeah, so they all get notified through the equivalent of like a student data system type thing. So they find out, but you know, if they want to share that information, fine, but the institution won't do that. And of course, even on things like Facebook, you know, sometimes people have to give their permission in a work context. I always think it's very funny when I do these interviews and I'm always putting myself out there and always aware that sometimes you think, I hope everyone in this picture is okay with them, with this being out there. But sometimes, you know, you have to sign all these disclaimers. And I think, you know, it really is fine. In fact, I insist that you do put this out rather than, you know, sign a waiver to say, you know. And I think that's the big difference, that at a time when institutions are having to be very careful and make sure that we don't breach people's confidentiality, we are breaching our own confidentiality on a daily basis to a degree that would have been unthinkable all those decades ago.
Of course. I mean, it's when people say, or some conspiracy theorist saying, oh, Bill Gates is out to sort of put microchips in us and, you know, monitor us. We are doing that ourselves. Everywhere we go, people are checking in. We know what complete strangers are having for breakfast, lunch and dinner, where they're having it, who they're having it with. So it's something that people are living their lives out there. It's like all of a sudden, I mean, you know, Andy Warhol's 50 Minutes of Fame, it's become true in a way, but it's much longer than 50 minutes because we are all celebrities in our own little bubbles.
Yeah. And sometimes I find, and I'm guilty of this, sometimes you put something out and you think, oh, this is a really important post. And it might be maybe like a film or something that means a lot to me. And you might get, if you're lucky, 3 or 4 likes or something. You're thinking, well, that's it. And then I tried this once. I put a picture of a cup of coffee. Just to, you know, it was somebody who served me at it, the barista who served me at work. We were talking about how 30 years ago, you wouldn't have a latte, not in a normal sort of, you know, cafe. It would be a milky coffee, but it was a bit more simple in those days. And so I just put the picture of my coffee cup on Facebook. And within moments, suddenly, I wasn't just getting likes, you know, in the dozens, but comments about blinking coffee cup. And I thought, hang on a minute. So when I put something substantial related to my work, I'd be lucky to get any interest. I put something very common or garden, and suddenly everyone's talking about it.
I mean, what I've realised is it's all to do with the algorithms. And for instance, if I put something on there promoting a show or a link to a YouTube video I've uploaded, if that's not going out, and I think a lot of them, they're monetizing content now, a lot of the platforms, so they won't. If they can spot a link, that won't go on there. Whereas if you just put something innocuous like a photograph, and then depends, it's self-perpetuating, because if somebody comments on that coffee cup, then it'll appear on someone else's feed, then they'll comment. So yeah, I've had the situation where a very humdrum picture seems to get hundreds of likes, and yet, as you say, you put something on which you think is rather, I might put a piece of, when the Queen died, I put a piece of music on. And actually, this is quite funny, Facebook contacted me saying, oh, potential copyright breach, we are muting this post in several territories. And then you had the option of disputing it. So I said, I cannot see what the copyright vote would be. This piece of music was written in the 19th century by Chopin. he's not still alive. It's out of copyright.
Yeah.
And then we write back sheepishly, oh, okay. And then there's a lot going on behind the scenes. You can't just post anything you want. But no, I totally agree. And there are, I mean, my husband does sort of courses on this sometimes, which I roll my eyes at. But they do sort of work telling you when you should post things.
Yeah.
If you post something at a certain time, it'll just get lost in the ether.
Because
we're one of billions posting.
Yeah, and I find sometimes, that, like with my interviews, if I put something out after midnight, you'd think, oh, that's the graveyard slot. You shouldn't be putting anything like that because everyone's in bed. Of course they're not. And of course people are overseas. So sometimes you forget that, well, you know, 1 a.m, there may be, it's only 7 in the evening in, you know, in LA or whatever. So of course people are then able to, you know, to comment. But I do find that it's the steamroll effect, that once one or two people comment, that it must appear on other people's feeds. In fact, I've noticed that occasionally, even happened to me yesterday, something that I posted in 2018, suddenly somebody liked. Now, why would they like that? You know, I mean, how did they find that? It's nothing that I've posted since. It was a sort of innocuous post, a photograph 4 years ago. But then once one person likes it, suddenly you get all these other likes, and you're thinking, well, obviously then, because that one person did it, the algorithms are set up in such a way that it's open to everybody. So we could do our interview now, and I might say, God, only a handful of likes, and who knows, in 3 years' time, suddenly this avalanche of, I can't believe you got to meet Chris.
I think it's really important to have perspective on all of this, and I can share a story with you if you like. We've got a lady in Munich, in Germany, who discovered our music online, myself and my husband's. We're called Tiano, Tanner and Piano, and we do, you know, we've been performing together for 21 years. She discovered the music completely by chance and engaged with us from Germany, never met her at that point, and then she asked if she could set up a fan page. Well, that was very flattering, so of course you can. So we'd send her, she's much more tech savvy than me, much younger, so we would send her musical clips. And then she actually flew to see our last two shows in London from Germany. And she actually deactivated the fan page a month or so ago. So I was a little taken aback. I thought, why would you do this? I knew she enjoyed it. So when she was over here, I just said, look, no pressure. If you got bored of it or you've moved on, absolutely fine. But you know, we know you like doing this. What was the reason for deactivating it? And she admitted, very candidly, that she felt people weren't engaging with it. People weren't liking her post, she was spending time on it. So I said, but do you enjoy doing it? Yes, was the answer. So if you enjoy posting things, that should be the end result, not waiting for likes and comments.
Yeah.
It's like we all know you can pay to have thousands of followers on there, which are just bots, so they're never going to engage with your content. So I said to her, look, if you like, let's do a little experiment. Shimmy and I will do a post explaining quite openly the situation, if you don't mind. She said, no, absolutely fine. And we'll appeal to people to follow this page. And it actually worked. So we did the video, we put it on all of the platforms, and she's happy. I said, you know, there might be an initial flourish of interest, but then it might go down again. So, but ultimately, if you enjoy what you're doing and you enjoy, if she loves the music so much, that should be the end result. It shouldn't be a case of doing it for something.
I think that's really well put, because sometimes there can be a real craftsmanship. I mean, I'm a huge radio person, but whenever I post anything radio related, it doesn't get, I mean, there are people I'm friends with who are radio nuts, and that's wonderful, and I'm up there with them. But most of my, say, university or school friends, not really, sort of, they're not going to comment on that to the same extent. But also, I'm not going to not post something because, I mean, it may make me think sometimes maybe I won't post quite so much of it, but I'll be more careful what I do. But also, if something really matters to you, and if you put your heart and soul into something, well, you know, in a way, as you say, it's irrelevant whether it gets one like or 100 likes, because you're not going to, you know, you're not going to suddenly say, oh, I shall change my set of interests because not enough people are liking it on Facebook. But there is a sense of endorsement, and I think that, and that's a different thing. And maybe it's back to what we were saying about school. We all need that validation sometimes, just to make people say, you know, I may not be interested in the same things as you, we may have different musical tastes, but actually, there, I respect what you're doing, and good for you. And that's sometimes all you need.
Yes.
You don't have to be a clone of the other person, but just enough to respect that you have your thing. I used to write the charts out every Sunday, the days before social media. I've still got them.
Yeah.
I used to write them up with different colour codes. And very eccentric, very OCD, and I'm sure all sorts of labels could be attached to me. But suddenly, all these decades on, it sort of means something, because it's like a
cataloguing endeavor, really. And that's why, I mean, I think with Facebook it's so good, because I personally enjoy each day checking out memories, and of course the purposes of Facebook, it's like nothing happened pre-2008, because that's when we all joined it, or some later. And actually, it's quite... It's great seeing what you've done, and, you know, and I think... And how we evolve. I mean, it used to be a case of... I would personally write in the third person. It would be... So it would be Chris Hamilton, I would say, is travelling to Colombo or somewhere. And I think, why was that even interesting? Nobody cares. But now we sort of, we write it as starting with, I have done this or I am doing that. But just seeing pictures. And actually, you know, friendships evolve, don't they? I mean, you know, you lose touch with some people. And it's a nice reminder of, gosh, this day 10 years ago, I did this. So I think... Even if nobody, and I can say this, and I am being genuine, even if nobody was looking at what I was doing, I would probably still do it.
Yeah.
And I like the fact on Instagram stories, for instance, and Facebook, that nobody but you can see who's looking at them or engaged with them. So it's not a competitive endeavour. It's not a case of, oh, well, 400 people have seen that story about me doing the vigil for the Queen the other week. You just see that yourself. And I genuinely don't even look to see who's been looking at them, because I just do it. If nobody looked at them, I just like the sound of my own voice, as I think we both do. And I like looking at myself.
Yeah.
and I do them. And I have shame in admitting that.
No, and I'm the same. And also, actually, funny thing about speaking in the third person, Bob Dole, do you remember who stood for the Republican Party nomination as president? And he was famous for always speaking about, Bob Dole thinks this. He'd always speak about himself in the third person. It was slightly weird, but kind of funny as well. He sort of thought, I think he knows he's doing this. But actually, you're right. It's finding your own voice. And I think what things like Facebook did for my own confidence, because it helped me see that I didn't have to show off in the sort of, look at an amazing academic piece of work I'm doing, you know, because I thought, because that really is not kind of me. The funny thing is, and this might surprise people who perhaps knew me at school, is that I'm in my element when I'm actually putting it, like, you know, because I feel good in myself. I mean, I dye my hair, I wear leather jackets, you know, I didn't do those things all those years ago. So, of course, for me, that's the thing that I put out.
Right.
And I like looking at myself, because what I then do, I feel good. I'm thinking, you know, and admittedly, even during lockdown, literally, my hair got a bit grayer and got a bit longer, and I didn't like the look of myself. So actually, the other day, I was looking, thinking, oh my God, anybody who's just randomly looking me up will think, God, Chris looks, you know, completely, you know, all over the place. And so I actually deleted some of those, just because I kind of thought, I'm comfortable in my zone now. But there's a serious element to that, which is that sometimes it's the way we project ourselves to the world. I don't think, and I know in school, I was not very confident. I didn't used to stand up very straight. I was always a little bit, you know, people used to joke about that. I'd always be sort of leaning over and all the rest of it, hunchbacked or whatever. So I'm very conscious that there was perhaps an image thing, which I feel I've now rectified.
Yeah.
So kind of the Facebook is my way of saying to people, it's like, well, you know, I'm on a journey. And you may not have recognised me 30 years ago. We were talking about a friend just now who was wearing those leather jackets and the shaven hair. And hopefully she might even be listening to this. and she was somebody who was a rebel from the standards of someone like me all those years ago. But kind of, I think we all have our, whether it's a midlife crisis or otherwise, you know, you don't have to be in your 40s to have a midlife crisis. But we all sort of find our way, and we all sort of find ourselves in the right sort of zone eventually.
Exactly, and I think, some people... See, I would look back on you, Chris, and think in school, you were mature, and so you did your own thing. And so that's the funny thing, because you had your friends there. What we were talking about before we went, you know, did this interview, it's interesting because it is cliquey schools, and I'm sure they still are, but I think with it, cliques aren't really thinking about other cliques. So you've got all the sports, the jocks in America, they call them. I don't know. It's I think, and I did my own thing too, and I wasn't ashamed of playing classical music.
Yeah.
I wasn't ashamed of putting my hand up and saying yes, miss. Yeah. You know, I remember joining Bishop Landorf, and they put me in the low set for maths, and I sort of marched up to the teacher and said, "Excuse me," you know, I had, which is mortifying, I had 97% in my last, you know, so I demand to go to to the top, you know, they did, but I mean, it was, that was not popular, and I'm sure it still isn't now.
Yeah.
I mean, in school, I think they've got their own challenges, but I'm sure people who, well, maybe it is, it's changed, I don't know.
Well, it's a different setup for me, because my children, my eldest, is going through what's called the Kent test. It's the 11 plus. Okay. Now, Kent has the 11 plus. We don't have it in other, we didn't have it in Cardiff. No. We were streamed at the age of 10 or 11, so when we went to secondary school, we were, as you say, put in different classes for maths or English or whatever, but we all went to the same school. But the thing that I found really interesting, and I'm not sure I think this isn't necessarily a good thing, but it means that at the age of 10 or 11, you are the school that you go to is predicated on your ability to do what, and it's not even necessarily academic ability so much as being able to do lots of very clever tests like logic and reasoning, right, and non-verbal reasoning and so on. So it's kind of showing that you have a particular aptitude, and it means all the people who go to that school have that same sort of aptitude. So you've got the schools of the gifted, you've got, obviously you have private schools as well, but then you also have the schools where all those who didn't get in, either by choice because they didn't sit the test, or they were, but they failed the test. So you've got at the age of 10 or 11 very different streams. Now, I'm glad I went to the school I did, because I grew in that school. If I'd had the Kent test equivalent at the age of 10 or 11, I suspect I probably wouldn't have passed it. But suddenly, by the time I, you know, did my GCSEs and A-levels, and certainly at university, I was kind of thriving.
Yeah.
But it took me a long time to get to that stage. So I think the answer is simply, it depends which school you're talking about and which county you're referring to.
Exactly.
I've got to ask about the music, because obviously that's the thing I associate with you most. Now, you, I'm guessing, didn't necessarily think that you'd be doing that professionally, or did you? Maybe to people like me, I see where you were then, I see where you are now, and it's like, you know, you're on a very stable trajectory. But was that the way you saw it? Did you imagine that you'd be doing something very different?
I think when I was very young, it was always the assumption that I would be a musician. And it was always classical music. So I used to compete in all these competitions in Wales and beyond and be very successful from a young age, winning prizes right, left and centre. So yes, that was always the goal. But then I had this wonderful piano teacher from Australia who, when I was offered a place at Oxford, she said, go there. She said, you know, it's Oxford, it's Oxbridge. You can always do a postgrad at the Royal Northern College of Music afterwards, because I was offered a scholarship there. So there was always that dichotomy of music and academia. And of course, going to Oxford, you become completely sucked into that whole very ambitious, competitive milieu, if you like. I did win the sort of instrumental scholarships. They had a bursary. I used to give classical recitals in the chapel. But at that sort of age, I decided that the life of a concert pianist was definitely not for me, in terms of it's such a solitary one. I mean, if you're a concert violinist, at least you're working with other musicians. Piano is standalone, unless you're going to enter a chamber ensemble. So, I also didn't want to do the necessary 6 hours a day that one has to do to sort of compete with the very best and go on. So it's interesting, you know, people always say, I mean, I do a lot of work on cruise ships now, performing as a headliner. So I'll go on a ship, you'll work with maybe up to 8 musicians, you give them your charts. It's a piano show with backing. In huge theatres, you have 1,000 people watching you. And you really get to meet the audience if you're performing for a week on a ship. And they'll come up and say, oh, what did your parents think when you gave up law? They must have been devastated. And I always say, and this is the God's honest truth, it was the other way around. They could not believe why I wanted to do law, because everything had been invested in music. I mean, I was travelling up to the Royal Academy of Music from Wales to London every other fortnight for piano lessons. As I said, I was excelling in competitions and all the grades. So it was a shock to them that I didn't want to do music. But I can honestly say that I wouldn't regret any of it. People might now think, gosh, so you did 3 years law at Oxford, 1 year at law school in London, 2 years with a big law firm to qualify into a banking litigation department.
Yeah.
What a waste. But none of it was. I think if I'd done what I'm doing now, maybe I would have got bored. I don't know. We can't say for sure.
Do you know, I think that's absolutely right. Because in my case, from the age of 6, I knew I wanted to do something on the radio. And yet I never did. And yet, everything I've done even in the job that I do now, is all about the sound of my own voice. Yes. You know, I will record myself, obviously, sometimes I have to record my own lectures. I'm very particular about how I sound, how I come across. Obviously, I do these interviews. Very interesting. So I ended up becoming a theologian, and I teach religious studies in a university, and I get to teach the things I want to teach. I teach my research. Yeah. So I've had a very fulfilling life, but I still haven't done, and I'm absolutely determined that I will someday do, maybe through the podcast, I'm actually already doing it, but actually do something in radio. So it's very interesting that I followed a path that has been good for me, and I don't have those regrets, but it's not quite what I set out to do, and it's almost like not quite enough. So how interesting, but wonderful that you had the support of your parents.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it is interesting. So question to you, you say you love the sound of your own voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you listen back to podcasts or recordings of lectures, what do you think? Because the majority of people, when they even hear themselves on a voice memo, or when they're leaving a message, they hate the sound of their voice. Whereas I don't know whether it's a musical ability I have. I hear myself as I sound.
Yeah.
This is an interesting question. I haven't really asked.
Well, sometimes, of course, there's a difference, because I do, as you'll find out, I do a 1 or 2 minute introduction at the start of each podcast, where, as a few people have said, and this is like the best thing somebody could say, they're like, you're doing your Radio 2 introduction. I'm thinking, yes, you know, please, you know, yeah, you couldn't have given me a bigger ego. Now, when I listened back to the original introductions I did 4 years ago, because I'm doing it in the ether kind of thing, and it's kind of pitching it, it's knowing who's listening to that, and I don't think I get it quite right, and I also have a background bit of music, and maybe that's a bit too loud and so on, as it drowns my voice out. So I'm much more confident with the notes, so I see that growth, and sometimes I listen and I think, God, you know, I want people to hear this, I want people to think, God, he's, you know, I could imagine him on the radio, because that's what I want to do, that's a natural follow-on. Now, sometimes when I listen back to older things that I've done, there's much more erring and ahring, the way that we all speak. But I've almost, and people have said this to me, that in normal day-to-day conversation, I'm very good at self-editing myself. And so I don't speak with lots of ums and ahs. I'm sure I do, but certainly when I'm doing the podcast, I don't have to take out too many of those. So I'm very aware of that. And part of me also feels that I need to know how I sound, because when I'm listening to myself, even doing my own podcast, I'm not necessarily imagining a particular person, but I may be imagining somebody I went to school with, or not a particular person, but somebody who might sort of think, what's Chris doing these days? Gosh, I'm really interested. I want to hear more. So I'm doing it for an audience, but I'm investing everything, because I never know which episode somebody might happen to come across, and they might only choose one.
So you take it has to be the best I do. Pride in it. Exactly. I've had to learn that over the years. I speak very quickly in real life. And if I'm performing maybe to an American audience, a lot would go over their heads just because of the speed. Mm. So I would have to slow down on stage, which to me, I'm doing it now, sounds almost artificial, but you have to. And I'm very interested with the whole umming and ahhing, because I hate umming and ahhing. And when I'm performing with my husband, Jimmy Goodman, he would say this, he's actually on a ship right now. If he starts a sentence with I'll say, no, just breathe. He speaks much slower than I do in real life, but when I'm on stage, I slow it down and think. What to you would seem like 10 seconds isn't. You can have a natural pause when you're talking, and even in real life when I'm talking to people, if you talk too fast, relentlessly, people will start to glaze. For sure, that's my experience. So you have to put a little bit of intonation in your voice. You have to pause and maintain eye contact. So these are things which, as you just mentioned yourself, you learn as you're going along.
And one thing I do find, and I think Terry Wogan was always very good at this, is that sometimes you know that in the right context, you might talk a bit quickly, you might be very aware that maybe you're speaking in a very slow way, maybe you're being very reflective, but then suddenly you'll change tone.
You sound very engaging. Also, actually, you've got a very nice modulation to your voice. You speak quickly, but it is engaging.
Yeah, and I think in that sense, it's a long-term process of not thinking, I sound all right. I mean, I can't listen to people's podcasts or indeed radio shows where they're ignoring the listener, where they're just talking to themselves, maybe having a bit of a laugh. That for me is
completely counterproductive. Right. The whole point is that you have to imagine that you've got somebody, and they might be a lonely person. It might, and I've had people write to me and say, look, I'm not in a very good place in my life. I'm not very happy. My life hasn't gone brilliantly. But I listen to you speaking to somebody for an hour, and I get to know something about them. They get to know something about me. And there's just that sense that it's like, and I've always presented the podcast as the sort of the radio shows I used to listen to, which don't happen now to the same extent. We'd have an in-depth conversation with somebody, maybe with a celebrity, but it would go off message. They wouldn't just be promoting their latest book, but they might be talking about, you know, the litter coming in or some nonsense they saw on TV the night before. And you're just hooked because it's the everyday. And it's that, you know, this is an important person who's having a rant about something they saw at the cinema last night. And you think this is, you know, they wouldn't have gone into the studio expecting to talk about that. But that's being listened to by millions of people. And I'm privileged that I'm privy to that conversation.
Exactly. And tying that in with what we said earlier about the whole engagement and likes and comments, you have to bear in mind that for every person who writes in and says how much it's affected them or they enjoyed it, there will be people who don't.
Yeah.
But they're still having the same response. It's like, that's why I don't particularly take reviews of restaurants to heart too much, because it takes a certain person to commit, to want to write down what they actually think of their meal last night. And it generally might be a negative, like service was terrible, food was lousy. And it was a real eye-opener for Shimmy and I during lockdown, because we, to keep ourselves amused, first and foremost, but also to entertain other people, we did these lockdown cabarets, and they became a regular thing. And it was amazing to sort of see people logging in, logging on, and then commenting as we were performing. Obviously, we couldn't see what they were writing because we were singing or performing a piece of music. But then afterwards, we'd sit back and look at all those comments. But then only... Well, now, 18 months later, we've realised that for everybody who did comment wonderful things, people wouldn't say negative things, they weren't that mean, because these are people we knew.
Yeah.
There were people who admitted that, without being melodramatic, we kept them from the ledge. People who were living by themselves, but they were silent watchers, if you like. So, yeah, we never underestimate just how many people you could be reaching. Not everybody is going to press like, or to us it's the easiest thing, and they'll just do a like or a tick. So that's quite interesting as well.
And also, for this podcast, you can see where in the world, literally the world, people are. And sometimes you expect, you know, people in London might be listening, or Bristol, or Cardiff.
Yeah.
But then suddenly you see that somebody in Bulgaria, or somebody in the United Arab Emirates, and there's a place, and you're thinking, well, I've never heard of this place. And it's like a small town just outside Boston, USA. And you're thinking, you know, I've reached somebody a long, long
it
way from here.
Phenomenal.
And I don't know who it is, but the fact that somebody there has clicked on this, and it may have made, and very likely somebody I've never met and never will meet, but hopefully for the good, it's made a difference to their lives.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. As we start to wrap up, Chris, I've got to ask, as you look back on your life, your career, you know, are your memories predominantly positive?
Such an interesting question. People who know me now would say that my memory is, well, sounds like I'm boasting, but it's not, incredible. For instance, I do this Oscars thing on stage, which is, I've learned every Oscar-winning song from 1934 until now, and I will do it live. People will give me a year, and I can tell them, like, Google what won the Oscar and what movie it came from. So people, it happens all the time, I come and say, do you have a photographic memory? It's phenomenal how you can do this, and I can meet somebody and remember their name 10 years later. However, I'm not one of those people who has vivid memories from the age of 4 or 5. Are you?
Well, I've kept a diary. Maybe that's a conversation area we haven't gone down.
Yes.
So I have a diary, but I don't have a good memory because I have a diary. The two go together. That doesn't mean to say that my memory is perfect.
Right.
If you remembered far more than I did about the particular year we were in and not the class we were in at school, I wouldn't have remembered it was 4A necessarily. But I do have memories, and I've always written them down.
I see. So how old were you when you started that diary?
9. So July 1982, the last day of the primary school, or of that particular year in primary school. But I didn't keep it up every day since. I mean, I've kept a diary for the last, a daily record for the last 30 years, but it was a bit hit and miss at school.
And do you is it a very honest account, or do you think it is? So you write everything you feel, because I think...
Everything, and the sort of stuff as well. But also, of course, back to what we were saying about data confidentiality, there are things in there that I'd have to be very careful about potentially publishing, because obviously there are people will tell me their innermost secrets, and somebody may have said something 20 years ago, and it's all there. So I have to be careful in that sense, but also... The older I get, the more I write. So I'm writing more than 2,000 words a day very easily. Gosh. So it's a huge commitment of my time, and I do either at the end of the evening or the start of the next day. But it's impossible to give up. I mean, do you do anything like that?
I don't. And in a way, I suppose, on a very superficial level, Facebook may be an easy substitute for that, because... Yes, I've got this sort of memory. I can look at a photo... If we're discussing something which happened... 10, 20 years ago, I don't just remember what happened, but where people were standing. It's quite an odd... Yeah. I mean, I haven't looked into it deeply, but I mean, yes, I think it's... The memory is better than the majority of people, because I'll... And it's something I've learned to sort of harness, because if I would go up to somebody and say, oh, we met 15 years ago, and they go, no, I don't think we did. I said, yes, we did, and I'll remind them of things we discussed... People might find that quite creepy, whereas it's nothing to me. It's just something that's in there amongst a mass of other useless information.
And I've had this with people, indeed, from school who I've been in touch with on Facebook. When I remember one of them, and I hope she'll be listening to this, who was, I remember, because maybe she just looked a bit older than the rest of us. And do you remember when the Madonna film Desperately Seeking Susan came out? Now, that would have been before you would have gone to the school, I think, 85. And I remember being really into Madonna, into the groove, all that sort of era. And she saw it at one of the local cinemas in Cardiff. Now, in 85, she's the same age as me, we would have been 12. But she obviously passed for 15, or they didn't care. Then they let her in. Yeah. And of course, I was like so jealous. Anyway, I was in touch with her on Facebook, and of course, I associate that with her. You were, and of course, I would think of that because I'm in that mode. I think of films. But she was like, you have this phenomenal memory. I can't believe you remember that. But for me, it's like, well, yeah, but there are also lots of things I don't remember. But I remember that because it was like it's strategic bits. But also, it's the random bits. I remember in your case, and I remember the day for a whole range of reasons, I was on the way back from an interview in Manchester, and we were on the train coming back. Do you remember we sat next to each other?
Yeah.
So that would have been, I know when it was. It was around the time, maybe the day before or just after John Major became Prime Minister. Right. So November or so 1990, we were on a train. I was coming back from an interview. So it's things like that, particular memories and particular conversations that we had. But I can contextualise all of that. If I suddenly mentioned a particular thing that we were talking about, you might be like, that's a bit freaky, how could you remember that? But it's just because it's in the context of that particular day.
I mean, I'm so fascinated with your diary writing, Chris, because I suppose you enjoy it, obviously, but yes, you can't stop now. It's like, how could you stop it?
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. Absolutely, and also I'm aware that and during periods of my life... when perhaps I wasn't in a good place and I lost my voice. Not, I don't mean literally lost my voice, but I was stuttering and stammering and I felt in a very awkward place personally. The diary overcompensated, and that's why I write so much. The diary was me able to write in a very unexpurgated way all the things I wanted to say that I couldn't perhaps say to somebody else.
Are you nervous that people would find them and read them, or how do you cope with that?
Actually, I'm the opposite. I'm desperate for them to be disseminated.
Really?
I'm aware. The thing that's holding me back is the fact that it could compromise my job. Yeah, and that would be a very, very big job. But, I mean, I suppose there is a part of me that thinks that, you know, after I've died, maybe people could do something with that. But I think, why wait till I die?
Yeah.
but I'm also aware that the consequences of doing that, I could end up ostracising. And also, you know, people might respond very negatively. Or maybe not. Maybe I'm just over-worrying about these things.
I think it's over-worrying and fear that stops us doing so much.
Yeah.
To be fair, isn't it? I think once you sort of get over that hurdle, you think, well, actually, anything's possible.
Yeah. But as you were mentioning Oscar songs, I mean, do you have a particular favourite? I mean, of all the sort of, since what, 1927?
1934.
Yeah.
That's when, I mean, the Academy introduced Best Song later. Do I have a favourite? Well, there were certain periods. I think the earlier songs are great. Simple songs like Moon River, 1961, Breakfast at Tiffany's, so simple, Audrey Hepburn playing it on the balcony on her guitar. One of the other favourites, Over the Rainbow, 1939, how could people not love that? Judy Garland. then you get all the Disney songs in the 90s, then it's interesting because when I perform these blindfolded on stage, I get 12 years, then make them into this big Oscars fantasia, if you like. And when you get to the sort of naughty, it's very peculiar. I mean, for instance, you got Eminem 2002, try doing that sort of rap, Lose Yourself on the piano. It's such a mix of songs the last 22 years, but yeah, the old romantic ones, 50s, 60s.
Wasn't there a moment when, was it Hustle and Flow, about the pimp, about there's nothing going...
It's hard out here for a pimp.
And
2005.
And they won...
And
the person who handed them the award was Barbara Streisand, and the look on her face, it was like, oh, I perhaps wasn't expecting that. And
Barbara Streisand won two Oscars, one in 1973 for The Way We Were, and then she co-wrote Evergreen, 1976. She's an EGOT winner, isn't she? She's got them all. So imagine writing your first and only song and it winning an Oscar.
And do you have ambitions in that direction?
I have composed music since I was a child, lyrics and music itself. It's, gosh, if the performing world is challenging, the composing world it's even more so. I did have successes probably around 10 years ago. I wrote a musical which went up to Edinburgh Fringe Festival and won the award for best music, came out to London, won some competitions. But there was a massive shift in what people... liked and were expecting, and I call it the Hamilton effect, if you like, even though I am Chris Hamilton. It wasn't a musical about me, sadly. And I think musicals started to ape pop music. And even the musical theatre performances were mimicking pop performances. I mean, the golden era of musicals were totally different. My style of writing, well, it probably would never go out of fashion because it's never particularly been in fashion. You wouldn't listen to it and think, oh, that's the song from Six, which is another hugely popular musical right now. But it means that songs I've written 20 years ago, I can perform in Crazy Cox, where I do a lot of performances with Jimmy Goodman, and people like them because there's nothing that challenging with them. They're sort of, you feel like you've heard them before, which I used to hate when people say to me, oh, that sounds like this song. But actually, it's a big compliment because if it makes people think... gives them a feeling of another song, then fair enough. So, yes, I love writing music. I'm not disciplined enough to do as much of it as I'd like to. If you really are that passionate, people say, don't wait for inspiration to strike. Just sit down daily, and whatever comes out, comes out. But I'm my own worst critic, so if I'm not feeling it, I don't necessarily commit to it. But though I've had songs recorded by well-known musical theatre people, which is very nice, and music published, and it's interesting, sometimes I get a phone call or a text saying, oh, I was on the auditioning panel and somebody sang your song to get into a musical theatre school. So it's all tied up with the performing. I can showcase my own work.
I mean, that's the dream, isn't it, to have that sort of validation by the very people whose work you admire. I mean, for me, interviewing somebody in the world of radio, for example, you know, for me is the equivalent of, like, you know, the Mafia, the Made Man type thing. It's almost like, you know, these are the people, these are my go-to people, these are the people I grew up with. And it sounds like you have a whole wealth of experience of actually coming into contact with the people who impress you and who's maybe who have inspired you over the years.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's the performing world is a very small one as well, really, in London. And I think it's, yes, you maybe have more access to, I imagine, radio, because that's done in studios. You're not necessarily socialising with other people who do the same thing. I could be wrong. But, I think as well it's very important. It's great to have ambition and to be competitive, but just to take stock and feel satisfied with where you're at. Because if you're perpetually striving for something bigger and better, more numbers, more followers, you can't actually, sounds very philosophical now, but you can't actually enjoy the moment and be proud of what you have actually achieved.
Yeah. And my very last question, which I ask everyone, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, gosh. I think neither. I think I very much live in the moment. To my detriment at times, because I can be quite spontaneous. When I was younger, quite reckless. Yes, maybe I should make more plans. People ask, what's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? I think you'd understand this as well. The older you get, you do tend to become a little bit more nostalgic. I don't wear the rose-coloured spectacles, however. I sort of managed to see things as they were, for better or worse. But I think I've become calmer, as probably we all do with age. And I'm realistic of what is achievable. And I realise that the things that I thought might have made me happy years ago probably wouldn't in the long term. So I think it's just all about appreciating what you have.
Yeah, Chris, it has been spectacular after 31 plus years. But to ourselves, we're still 18-year-olds.
I know. I mean, look at our enthusiasm. Yeah. And it's true, I haven't even seen you. We just spoke on Twitter a few times, but it feels like yesterday.
Absolutely. So, Chris, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you for having me, Chris.